Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, Episode 21, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. Chicago public schools have drastically cut back on librarians. Is this a growing trend? Plus, more and more schools are getting rid of the valedictorian-salutatorian system. We'll tell you why. And one university is now allowing payment for college with bitcoins. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education, plus we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week we're talking to an expert with DonorsChoose.org. If you've been thinking about using the service to fund the classroom project, we've got some tips for you. Hey everybody, Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined with student data expert Russ Davis of School Status and teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how's it going over there?
It is going pretty good.
I know that you can nerd out with me a little bit here. Did you see the Star Wars trailer this week?
I not only saw the Star Wars trailer, but I also bought my tickets on Fandango.
Me too. Yeah, I got them already. So I got me 5 tickets and ready to go. And it's nice because the local theater here now lets you reserve seats. So they don't even have to worry about.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. You know, you don't have to worry about trying to fight for that seat. Hopefully there's some Star Wars experts or fans out there that are feeling us though and are jacked up about
this.
The
trailer looks fantastic.
I thought
the way that they left the previous movie really just lends itself to a lot of things creatively that can happen. Who's the director on this one, Nick?
Is it Rian? Am I saying it right?
I don't know.
Or it might be Ryan. It's R-I-A-N.
It's not J.J. Yeah. Abrams, though, right?
No. Abrams is doing the next one, though.
Gotcha.
There was some switching up there, and he's now doing the third in this series.
I think Abrams makes a superior movie, frankly. Like, of watching the different Star Wars, I think J.J. Abrams does a great job.
He did a great job. And think about it. He put his whole career on the line to do that.
Sure.
I mean,
there's no worse. Right. You know, he's kind of in that sci-fi genre.
Right.
So there's no worse fans than Star Wars fans that, like,
maybe Star Trek fans, but
You know, he's doing Star Trek, too. Did
right.
you see that also? He's doing the NBC Universal deal.
Right.
But anyway, back to Class Dismissed. We could turn this into a science fiction podcast just like that.
You're right.
Yep,
you're
you
right.
Think you did.
Lissa, save us. What's going on in the teacher's lounge?
I am talking about a story out of Chicago, an article from the Chicago Tribune. Obviously, Chicago public schools are in the news a lot, as are public schools across the nation with budget cuts and things. But this one focuses on librarians. 3 years ago, 454 librarians employed, to where now this year, 139.
Wow.
So a lot of cuts in librarians.
Did you know this was happening, Russ? Librarians?
You know, I didn't know that. I'm not familiar with the CPS story, but I know that most states have accreditation standards that require librarians and counselors, and like in order to keep your accreditation status with your state accrediting body, you have to have like one librarian per X number of students or something like that. Same thing with counselors.
So I'm gonna play devil's advocate. Listen, why are you rolling your eyes?
Because I saw your face. Because I saw your face like 5 minutes ago.
I'm gonna ask the question that Russ and Lissa may not want to ask. In the world of, you know, Siri, Wikipedia,
incredibly important. Let me just stop you right there.
All right.
Okay.
Librarians are incredible.
Exactly.
It's called library science for a reason.
Right. And they are not just the keeper of the books. They are
not
the gateway to information anymore. That's gone. You know, they teach a lot of things. They actually teach media lit. Do you know what that is? No.
Of course.
No, you don't. They actually teach children, okay, in the world of immediate news, how do you tell which is fake news and which is not? What's a credible source? What's not? Mm-hmm. How to cite? How to... You know, obviously in the younger ages, early literacy, you know, just even the joy to read.
I just follow the cues from our president.
Oh, my gosh.
I think that they have really, I think what quote unquote librarians have done a great job of doing is evolving. and probably more so than most professions in education, in True. That they have, they're now media specialists, and that's kind of their, and I'm going to get like hate mail over this. Be sure to give out our email address, or give out your email address, Nick. But I think that, because I'm sure I'm butchering it, but actually the vice president of our company, Nick Peterman, his wife, Cindy, right. is a librarian media specialist. And I kind of had the same opinion you did until she set me straight. And I did a lot of research on it, and I think that they are very necessary. And I wasn't aware of what Lissa was saying. I wasn't aware that they were helping to determine what is real and fake news. I think that that's great, and I think it's really tough these days. It's something that's important to teach kids because we're kind of in a brave new world. And they're not just the keepers of the Dewey Decimal system anymore. I think that they're very important. Very important in schools. Now, I think the point that you were getting at was, you know, who do you say first? You know, do you keep teachers, or do you, you know, kind of let these what some consider ancillary employees go? And
well, football coaches are last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Art teachers are first. Librarians, music teachers. I guess maybe that's why I'm out of the gate defensive, because it is, you know, these supplementary teachers that seem to be the first to go. And honestly, in the article that I'm speaking of, the librarians say that they have been pressured to teach English courses or things like that in order to keep their job. So they may be a librarian one period a day. And, you know, when I think of library when I was younger, you know, we did visit the library, select a book and silently read, or maybe when I was younger, the librarian would read a story. That's not really how library is anymore. The librarians, you know, it's library science. So they are required to present a lesson, usually on a smart board, to the class that's visiting. And it has to be something that, you know, promotes understanding of story structure or setting or how to locate the main idea, things like that that are, you know, sometimes a little ambiguous to kids. But, you know, you've got now all these schools that don't even have a librarian. So there is even not even just a visit to the library. A lot of libraries in a lot of schools across the nation are just used as a room of books where you do testing in, where you pull out children and do, you know, some kind of a resource, something supplementary with the children. And if you think about kids that are in poverty areas, like children in Chicago, they probably do have a public library in their area, but it's probably not safe to go there. And they may not have an adult that could take them. And then, okay, so maybe they should purchase books. Well, obviously, they don't maybe have the money to be able to do that. So their school libraries are their only option, and you're taking them away. And, of course, this story out of the Chicago Tribune actually highlights the fact that the librarians that they didn't cut are in the higher economic areas. The ones that they did cut are the ones that really could use it the most.
I'm all for keeping the librarians. Those are teachers, though. They can go. We can just cut them right away.
if librarians are teaching kids how to research and actually, you know, find information, I'm all for it. Well, Russ, I know you got another one that's going to probably get some folks riled up.
Well, yeah. So I'm hearing more and more schools are getting rid of class valedictorians and salutatorians. Have you guys heard of this?
No.
Not until like a day or two ago. I did not know this was a thing.
There was a Wall Street Journal article, and the site, because I don't want to pay for the Wall Street Journal, already pay for the Times and our local newspaper. I'm not adding the Wall Street Journal to my mix. It's by a site called Simple Most, and basically they were talking about schools are phasing out the traditional of naming a valedictorian because they think it breeds unhealthy competition amongst students. And furthermore, they're also half the schools. I work in education every day of my life. I've never heard of this. Half of U.S. schools no longer report class rank.
So when I stumbled across the article on Simple Most, and Simple Most is one of these news sites that looks for like talker type stories, I was kind of like, this can't be true. Like this. And then I went and found it on Fox News. And then I found the Wall Street Journal article as well. And I was like, all right, well, This must really be happening.
But why?
They're saying that the competition that it creates is unhealthy. And they're saying the class rank, like if you have a student who is a 3.9 GPA, she may be ranked 12th out of, you know, in her class if the 11 students in front of her have a 4.0. So it looks like she wasn't at the top of her class, even though she was a 3.9 GPA. Let me just go ahead and say, you're not at the top of your class. They have a 4.0 and you don't.
Like, well, but that's still the top. And I think that universities, they, I mean, I know that with my high schooler, whenever we filled out things, they ask how many are in your graduating class.
Yeah.
They ask that question, mm-hmm. which honestly, this is a funny story since we're talking about class rank, because my high schooler just got his class rank last week and he texted it to me from that cell phone he's not supposed to be using in school. Mm-hmm. So he texts me his class rank. Mom, guess what? I'm 66 in my class rank. Well, unfortunately, I was not pleased with that number. So I was like,
how many are in his class?
So, well, okay, that's part of the story. So I'm like,
1,000.
I was like, what? That's ridiculous. I thought your GPA was like a 3.8 something. And he was like, it is. And I was like, why are you 66? So of course, I'm immediately, you know, like, the school has made a mistake. This is a mistake. And I will get to the bottom of it.
You were that parent.
Yes, I was.
Immediately, you turn into an adversarial relationship with the school, right?
Yes. Yes, that's me. Right. So anyway, so I'm just like devastated, kind of. And so, because I'm thinking of my class rank, and I'm thinking, really, more importantly, my twin sister had a really high class rank. And so I'm thinking, mine was
not.
So
therefore, you sort of had that class rank, right?
Well,
your twin sister, I mean, we could borrow that.
Kind of helped her along from the beginning. But no, but I'm still thinking, even compared to my class rank, which wasn't as awesome, my son's was not anywhere close to that. And so I was upset. But then I think, oh, I only had 125 kids, I think, in my graduating class, and he has like 480, which I did not believe. He said, Mom, that's really good out of 480. And I said, there's no way you have 480 kids in your graduating class. And he was like, Mom, I swear. So I had to check. I called the office to make sure that there was 480 kids in his graduating class, and I guess 66 out of 480 is great. And so honestly, like you said,
he's in the 94th, 95th percentile?
Which is great, in my opinion. Yeah. You are the top of your class, you know? So I don't think it's fair to say number 12 isn't the top of her class. Yes, she is. And it's a she. Yes, she is.
Apparently, I've touched upon a nerve. Apparently. Somebody's bringing up from high school.
Well, but I also think
maybe this is unhealthy. I think
no, it's not.
Yeah.
Also, let's be honest: the people that usually stereotypically are valedictorian and salutatorian and are battling it out, probably from seventh grade. You know,
prepare
they
to
know,
cut this, Nick.
They know.
I don't know what's coming next, but you're sure are building up for a pitch.
Whatever, right? These children,
Nancy Kerrigan story.
They
coming
up. Exactly.
They know who their competitors are, and most of the children that are competing for this honored title are that is their thing. That is their thing. So they may not be the star quarterback. They may not be, you know, the most amazing person on show choir or whatever. So why are you taking away their thing?
I was going to make the same point. It's like even a local junior college around here, and I think they're a client of y'all's, Russ, they honor these salutatorians and valedictorians from all the local schools every year. And that's really one of the few honors they get.
Right.
Again, I've preached about this. I mean, we put sports on a pedestal. It's very competitive. Why are we choosing to take this away when it comes to academics? I don't get it.
Yeah,
I tend to agree. Just by the way, I was thinking about the folks that were – I graduated with in a small town with 106. I was dead in the middle of my class, by the way, nowhere near the top. And I was just looking at – well, were they really successful? But I think our top three, I just wrote down doctor, rocket scientist, literal rocket scientist, and doctor. So I guess they were pretty successful.
Yeah,
after all. But I think that what they're trying to get at is that it creates this, you know, unhealthy competition or something like that. And I could understand that point, but there's a high school outside of Boston where schools, they have the school committee has voted to reinstate the valedictorian title. The committee decided student feedback, collecting via survey, which they said 87% of students and 95% of faculty supported reinstating the tradition. So, I mean, I do think it matters. I think if somebody has put in the extra time and has earned that title, I don't understand where, and again, this is something to put on my crotchety old get off my lawn hat, but I don't know where we got to the point where competition is somehow unhealthy. I mean, unhealthy competition is unhealthy, but I don't know that this is something that somebody works for their entire high school career for 4 years and they're studying and others are partying. Or some people just get it naturally. Like, I went to school with some guys that just, they could do whatever they wanted to and they were going to score 100 on every test. Like, they were just those guys. I think life is competitive, right? I think life is a competitive place and you're going to have to compete in this world and competition's important. And I compete every day. You know, I mean, our company competes with other companies in the marketplace. I'm incredibly competitive. So I guess maybe I can't relate and maybe I haven't seen my child. Maybe I would feel differently if my child was the one who was crying because, you know, everyone got a 4.0 and she had a 3.9 and was ranked 12th.
Yeah. You know, she wouldn't be. She wouldn't be crying. She would say, I'm at the top of my class. She would know that there's 480 people behind her. And those children usually are. They usually are recognized as the, what do they call them? Top of the class or honors. Yeah, they are recognized also. So it does matter. And I really want to know these schools that took away the title of valedictorian and salutatorian. I bet you they have a homecoming queen. I bet you they do. I bet you they have class favorite, most likely to succeed. If you're going to recognize kids for that, then you should recognize valedictorian and salutatorian.
I can tell you this, like somebody that graduates top of their class at Harvard Law, they're going to put that on every job application ever. They're not going to put graduated summa cum laude. They're going to put above that, I was number three in my class at Harvard Law or whatever it was.
What's the old joke? What do you call a doctor that graduates last in his class?
Doctor.
I think the conclusion is it's really healthy except for Lissa. She now has high blood pressure.
I just think it's silly to take it away.
And her twin sister scored better than her in high school.
Even on the ACT, like when our ACT, you know, back when they mailed you your score, I remember the first time that it came in the mail, she like quickly opened it and it was like out of the gate, like boom, you know, like wow. And I just took mine to my room. Like I didn't even open it. Like I just knew. I just knew like no shot. Mine's
where
in
is
clothes.
Your tear stained ACT results? Lisa, where do they live in this world? Surely you kept those. That's gonna be tough. So
well, I've got a story that it's not K-12, but since we've got Russ on the headsets here, I want you to make sense of this for me. And I haven't briefed you on this.
Yeah.
But it's a Bitcoin story. And if anybody knows about Bitcoin, if I needed a lifeline on Bitcoin, I'd probably call Russ.
I could give you a list of 15 other people that work in our office that would know more, but I know a pretty decent amount about it.
Well, good. So a university in Switzerland has now said they are going to accept Bitcoin as tuition. They're using a middleman to kind of take that money and then convert it to Swiss francs on a weekly basis, sometimes daily if it's enough
That's
money.
That's not shady at all. But, I mean, like the words converting Bitcoin to Swiss francs immediately says.
Right. Like what? I'm sorry. I think.
But help me wrap my mind around this. And anybody who has no idea what Bitcoin is other than just hearing the word.
Bitcoin is based on the premise that you're converting computational energy into something of tangible value. And so there are very complex math problems that these computers solve. And if you'll think back to the gold rush, the California gold rush, whenever you first got there, like there was gold everywhere. It was on the ground, it was in the streams. You could find it anywhere. And so people made a lot of money. And then it got harder and harder to find because it's a finite resource. Bitcoin is very much in the same way. So when you solve bits and pieces of these cryptographic puzzles, and I'm grossly oversimplifying it. Someone is screaming at his car radio.
Well, because right, I mean, you've almost lost me.
Okay, so they're solving
complex
math problems.
Well, I'm just sitting here thinking maybe I didn't know what Bitcoin was because I thought Bitcoin was something completely different than what you're saying.
So Bitcoin is actually a cryptocurrency. So by solving math problems, it's called mining. So by solving math problems, it gives us the results of those math problems, and that is a tangible thing. Like that Bitcoin is a thing that you can then go, and there's only one like it, and there's only a finite amount of it. And as more people solve the math problems, they grow more and more complex. So it becomes harder and harder to solve. So people that started—
So it's backed with math, essentially, just like our money's backed with gold?
It's backed by math, basically, yeah. Yeah. It's solved a very hard, difficult math problem and a series of math problems. And I'm not going to get into how blockchains work, but basically, once you have a Bitcoin, there is a distributed network that lets you like sell off a piece of the Bitcoin. So if I want to sell 0.1 Bitcoins, then I could give you that little piece of that Bitcoin, and then you could take it, bring it to an exchange, which then converts it into real dollars. So the current, as of right now, the current price, I'm looking it up on coinmarketcap.com.
And while you're looking that up, I'll say the university in Switzerland is the Lucerne University of Applied Sciences and Arts.
So they're, so just by the nature of that, their people that go to that school have some, they've got some Bitcoins lying around, I'll just tell you that. So the market cap for Bitcoin right now is about $87 billion, or $87 billion in Bitcoin value. Bitcoin is now at $5,240 right now. It's up 8.7% today, right? So that's why it's gotten a lot of press recently, is it has exploded, basically. And there's been some corrections lately, but there are about 16 million Bitcoins floating around right now. The max supply is about 21 million Bitcoin.
Fun fact, and I haven't verified this, so it's not, maybe I shouldn't say fact, but I think the Winklevoss twins, you guys know who the Winklevoss twins are?
Mm-hmm. They're trying to do an ETF, yeah.
Yeah, they're like one of the biggest shareholders of Bitcoin. And Winklevoss twins, for those that don't know, those are the two guys, if you ever watch the movie Social Network about Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, they're the two twins at Harvard that basically said they invented Facebook, and I think there was some undisclosed settlement. This is a fragile market, though, right? Like, this whole thing can collapse.
It's incredibly volatile. Yeah. Please, no one invest your retirement in this. Like, it is a terribly volatile market. But just I'll give you an example of how much it's going up, and there's going to be a correction here soon enough. There already have been some pretty decent-sized corrections over the past few weeks. But just back a year ago today, Bitcoin was worth $612. And today it's worth $5,200.
Like Bitcoin is $5,200.
Yeah, one BTC, one Bitcoin. Yeah. And so what folks are trying to do is they're trying to get permission to create ETFs, which are electronically traded funds. Mm-hmm. And so where you could buy Bitcoin and put it in your retirement portfolio or something like that, it would be traded like any other ETF. But so far, the U.S. has been incredibly resistant to that.
I mean, there's nothing there except finite math.
I mean, I think you could – yeah, I think you could say that there's nothing in the U.S. dollar because it's backed by – I mean, we went away from the gold standard in the 70s, so it's backed by the full faith and credit, and that's it. This is actually something that there's a finite amount of and is tangible, and you could – I mean, you could truly – like there's like a – there are ATMs where you could put your wallet, you could log into your Bitcoin wallet, and it will spit out money and take your Bitcoins and convert it into cash. I think the scary part for most governments is that like North Korea is getting into Bitcoin now. Like they're – because you can't restrict the trade of Bitcoin. You get what I'm saying? Like right. It's not like you can like, yeah, you can't, like seize you bank can't accounts or whatever. It, yeah. Yeah, like it is like having a gold bullion reserve essentially. You can't get rid of it. So
this is how nerds take over the world.
I think it's how nerds created something from nothing, for sure. I mean, look, I laughed. Like my wife told me at work, this was years ago, that that somebody at work had bought some Bitcoins, and I said, that guy's an idiot. Literally said that. And that was probably in 14, maybe 2014, 2013, somewhere in there, where Bitcoin was $150. I mean, he's gotten, I don't know, quite a return. I can't do the math right now, but he's gotten hundreds and hundreds of percent return on that investment now.
Yeah.
But, okay, so if he bought the Bitcoin, he didn't solve the math problem.
That's right. And so there are people that are mining. So mining and then trading are two different things. But I will say this, there is, you should read about this. There is a guy that kind of started Bitcoin supposedly. And it's like, they've been trying to find this guy for years and years and years. And he invented that too.
He invented the internet.
So, but they he owns like a crazy amount of Bitcoin. Like it's billions upon billions upon billions of dollars of Bitcoin. And it's just sitting there. Because with Bitcoin, people think it's an anonymous cryptocurrency. It really isn't. You could see every transaction that's ever happened. It's like being able to look up the serial number of a dollar bill and it telling you everything that's ever happened with that dollar bill, anytime anybody's ever used it, because that's how it's tracked. And so, like, there's this huge stash of Bitcoin that's out there that no one really knows who owns it because they can't find the guy that started it. And it's like an alias, and he showed up on a few message boards. And like, let me tell you this, if the nerds on the internet can't find you, you don't, like, you're never going to be found. Like, they'll never find this person.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's nuts.
My mind's blown. My mind's completely blown.
Yeah, sorry. I know it's like really nerdy. It's hard to explain.
No, it's interesting.
I try to use that gold analogy to like try to get it across, but it's...
I had no idea it was backed by math, and I knew a little bit about it, but that, like,
yeah,
that's crazy.
People buy GPUs. They buy, because of the nature of the equations, they're best solved by graphics processors, not CPUs in your computer. And so what sucks, if you're a gamer, like if you're building your own gaming rig, like the market, the cost of video cards have skyrocketed because people are buying them to mine Bitcoin.
Wow.
Which is nuts. So anyway, the more you know.
Ding, 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 ding. I don't know if I can do that. I might owe someone money now for doing that. let's go ahead to the bright idea. Are you guys ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
In today's Bright Idea, we have our first scientist joining us. Dr. Steve Farber is an investigator in the embryology department of the Carnegie Institution for Science and is an adjunct associate professor in the Johns Hopkins Biology Department. Dr. Farber, how are you doing?
Great.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Farber, I've looked at your bio. It's extremely impressive. You have tons of schooling up and down the East Coast, but you've also dedicated a significant amount of time and resources to K-12 science education, and you do this with a program you call BioEyes, and BioEyes really all started with a fish, right?
Correct.
Tell me about that.
Well, I would start by saying, I take myself back to 2002, and I was a new assistant professor at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, and they had started a tradition of doing a take your child to work day. And you can't have a lot of little kids running around a big city hospital research environment. So they organized that effort in that all the kids were brought together in one big room and they were taken on tours. And someone had the bright idea, you know, let's bring them to Farber's lab. It's like the aquarium, because my animal of choice that I work on for my science is zebrafish. And they had just built me a state-of-the-art zebrafish facility. And so they brought the kids to see the fish. And so I set up little stations where they could see these fish larvae at different stages. And since zebrafish are optically clear, you can see right through their bodies at every cell. That's why we use them to study, in my lab, cardiovascular disease and diabetes and all kinds of things that to help people. So the kids came in through the lab and they saw the beating heart. And at the end of the whole day, guess whose program was considered the most interesting? It was Farber's lab.
Hey. Right?
So what I learned about any big institution is that if you do something well, there's one thing that's going to happen to you. You're going to get asked to do that thing over and over and over again. And so all of a sudden, I had all these tours, and my lab started to complain. They're like, Steve, you know, we're getting all these tours. So my wife suggested to me, who's a social psychologist, a PhD, she's like, if the university is so interested in having you show off these fish, why don't they give you a little funds to hire someone? So I was walking in my building in my usual attire of jeans, which could have had a rip in them, and a t-shirt. And I noticed this big display of coconut shrimp and wine, and thinking, you know, I'm a professor now. Even though it was for the surgeons, they were having some event. I said, you know, I'm going to take a bunch of these shrimp and wine because, you know, I don't know, I like that stuff. So I grabbed some of it, turn around, and then who's in front of me but the dean of medicine. And I just look at him and say, like, you're the dean, right? And he goes, Farber, you just got this Pew Scholar Award, and I sponsored a group that came to your lab, and they had a great time. And then that comment from my wife came out. I go, you know what? If I can get some money to hire someone,
right,
this would be a lot more effective. And he looked at me like quizzically, and then he said, look, I can get you like $35,000, but if you, but you'll need to go to the other deans. Don't tell them it was me. Tell them an unnamed dean and find the rest of the money for the salary. And he started it. And the key moment there was the person I hired was a former teacher who had a master's degree at the time in science education, Jamie Shuda. And I interviewed her with my 8-year-old son. Mm-hmm. I interviewed one other candidate. And her charisma and interaction with my son was so notable that and enthusiasm, she got the job. And she took this crazy idea. You see, when I went to a classroom, I lined kids up behind a microscope. They're like punching each other. I don't know how to run a classroom at all, you know. And so Jamie, the first thing she did was ground the whole program in existing standards. Fast forward, we have 100,000 kids that have done this. And what the success of this program is because we hooked together a scientist who really wanted to improve STEM education with a tried and true teacher who understood how classrooms work.
Well, I have to say, as a teacher, even though I'm not a science teacher, I feel like across the nation there's so many new young educators that we don't even really dabble too much in the sciences.
I learned that this program is a teacher professional development program. I used to think it was the kids. It was all about the kids. But now I understand that when you change a teacher, when you enable a teacher to feel comfortable with a scientific concept and tools, you affect that teacher for their entire career. You know, this is what I tell the teachers when they come in for their weekend, their PD. I say, look, my lab is concerned with stuff that's not on the internet. It's not in Wikipedia. It's at the frontiers of knowledge. It's stuff that we have to create. And I want the brightest, smartest, most diverse, talented people to come to my lab. And before they're in my lab, they're in your classrooms. And I am just so psyched that you are coming to this training because we're all on the same team. And you should see the reaction of the teacher, the idea that I would think of them as a partner. And that is not like bull. I mean, it is my feeling, it's my heart. That's why I do this.
You know, you're almost awakening inside them what was never really sparked from the beginning.
Exactly. Exactly. There are so many issues that BioWise offers that we didn't know when we did it. For example, it's a fifth grade and seventh grade modules. And in fifth grade, you know, it's what is the words? Male, female, sperm, egg, embryo. The kids actually figure out which is a male and which is a female, and they put them together, and then they collect the embryos the next morning. Well, I think it's obvious, right? This is about sex. And we're talking about the United States, which in school settings all over the country, that issue is challenging for teachers, even though it's clearly age appropriate. So that aligns with national standards. But because it's fish and because they just swim near each other and you don't have any mechanical issues to discuss, literally no one gets upset about that curriculum topic. So as a scientist, that's kind of a fun aspect. Second aspect is, what is the experiment? Well, we mix, the kids have to mate a fish that does not have pigment to a fish that does have pigment. Now, in the high school unit, they learn about the genetics of pigmentation. Well, that's race. And so most kids in an urban setting, their only concept of race is a social construction. And what they learn with our unit is there's one gene that was actually discovered in fish that explains the biggest chunk of why somebody's skin is darker or lighter. And there's one little change that happened in that gene to make skin lighter. And they come away with an entirely different perspective than they had before. So these are two really difficult topics that are relevant but are challenging for teachers to address. But when you do it with a fish in the way we do, you can have all these discussions. Even in fifth grade, you can see the kids are so focused on the fish. They're looking at the fish and they'll say, like, my female doesn't like my male because she is running away. And they project so much of our sexual stereotypes on the fish, you know, and they go in there thinking right off the bat, because the female fish is so much bigger than the male, they always think that the male is the female is the male. Mm-hmm. So that's against their expectation. Then when they learn, they dig into that a little more, they'll realize, oh, the female's bigger because she has so many eggs, right? And then we put this little tree in there so the male can actually hide, because sometimes the female is so much bigger, she'll whack him, the male's dead. So this little male is in there, and then it's the female is assessing the male. So from a scientific concept, we can introduce fitness. Like, if you're, and they'll say, like, my they're chasing. So you could sit down with fifth graders and go up to the board and say, okay, what kind of skills do you need to chase? You need to be have good muscles, you have to see, you have to do this. And you make this whole list and you realize, like, well, what if my male's, like, sick? Do you want to waste your eggs on a sick male? So then all of a sudden, they're thinking about how the female is deciding from the male's performance. Like, is this male any good? Well, it's so interesting when you see how they have all these biases about the way people act. So it's just extra fun when it happens in fish to be opposite the other way. Then kids come in with the sex biases that the male is the one making these decisions, and actually the female is the one assessing everything. You can go to bioeyes.org and see some of the movies. You'll see every kid from across the world, and they act the same. They just stare at these fish. They could even be special needs. There's something about a living creature, and they make very similar observations. So I think that's another aspect about why BioEyes is so effective, because the kids focus amazingly intently.
So can you give me an example of a time maybe you were working with a child and you just saw them get it?
Some teachers would develop PowerPoints and kind of tell kids the outcome, and I'd have to go, no, you got to let them make these, quote, mistakes. And there's an amazing movie from Baltimore County of a team of kids where they're being interviewed, and they said, you know, our group had 234 embryos, and we were really excited. But then we accidentally put them on top of the heating pad instead of in the special container. Oops. And then it cuts to the other girl, and she said, well, look, in science, mistakes happen. Mm-hmm. And we put them in this container they shouldn't have been, and then she looks into the camera and goes, so they all died. And, you know, when you show this to scientists, the room erupts in laughter, because it's like, welcome to our world.
Right.
And why I love that is you can tell a great teacher was behind that, because that teacher coached that child and said, look, this is part of the scientific process. So allowing kids to have that experience and to kind of not succeed is as much an important part as succeeding. Sometimes the kids set up the cross in the male and the female, and guess what? She doesn't like the male or whatever, and that animal, that pair doesn't lay eggs. Well, we introduced the concept of adoption. So one of the other teams has to give embryos to their other classmates. Well, you can imagine the group, like if a group has 500 eggs and they're giving them out to the other team, that group thinks they are in the top of the world, you know? They're walking around the class like, our group got 580 eggs and we have to give them to everybody else. So I think the ownership is obvious. And then even the very fact that they have to pick up the dish and carry it across the room, and so they're so careful, and the almost you could see the pressure in a classroom, they're like holding the dish. Well, I think all that emotion helps the learning process, because they're like holding the fate of these animals literally in their hands.
True.
And we bring writing skills in, because we say you have to write an essay from this perspective of the embryo, from the larvae. And they all write about, I was really worried my parents were going to eat me, or the students came over to suck the poop out of my dish, and I was worried if I was going to get sucked up, but I didn't get sucked up. So, you know, kids have a universal reaction to some of these kinds of things, whether they're in Australia or Chile or the United States. And I think when you talk to a fifth grader about the idea how these animals do sometimes eat their babies, that's like pretty. There's one kid on one of the movies says, I was talking to my dad at dinner, and I was telling him that these parents, these they can eat their babies. He says, that's not being a good parent, that's, you know? And so this is the natural world. This is, you know, sometimes we're so worried about making everything perfect for kids, and they should know that different animals have different strategies.
I pardon the pun. I'm hooked. I am so excited about this. And I have two boys that meet the age range that you keep referring to for these modules. I would love to know how to tell a teacher or a principal or educator, what do they do?
Well, I mean, this is our biggest challenge, what you're touching on, because people all want to have the program.
The first thing, the good news is that the zebrafish is such an amazing model system for the lab setting. Like a mouse costs about $1 a mouse a day. A fish costs about $2 or $3 a year. Wow. And we now know, I mean, this may be shocking to your listeners, but it's the same sets of genes that are in us, are in the fish. So wow. If we're trying to figure out how a gene works, or if we're trying to find a new drug, it turns out it works often exactly the same. So you can so there's all these great reasons that make the fish an amazing system are the same reasons it makes it great in a class. But because the fish is now in all the major universities, the first thing is, are you based near an academic university that has a fish system going? And then you build from there. Like some of the faculty who've never done it before, we have to kind of launch BioEye. So it isn't the kind of thing you can kind of order a textbook and do it. We've had motivated teachers really figure out how to do this with pet store fish and stuff. But that takes a lot of effort. Right. So we have all the, what we call our replication model is in our last publication, which is the Public Library of Science Biology, which is a high profile form journal. We published what it takes to replicate, but so you need the academic institution, you need the kind of infrastructure sort of built to support the delivery. So they reach out to bioeyes.org. We have, right after our paper came out, we have like 90 requests for replication across the globe, with a large chunks in the U.S. So all of the UC schools out in California, UCLA, UC Davis, Boston, the Harvard and MIT, you have all on the East Coast schools. So the major big name schools, we've seen a lot of activities happen there, but it does require a connection to an academic center.
Dr. Farber, kudos to you and your team for taking, you know, science and what's complicated and getting kids interested in it. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
All right, I'm ready.
All right.
I had my coffee. I'm all geared up.
All right, it shouldn't be too tough.
Okay.
If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be? I think I know what your answer is going
to
be.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with, you thought I was going to say science, and I probably would, but history is really important too, so it's
all
a
right.
Tie.
You threw me for a loop there. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Analytic thinking and open-ended questions that kind of STEM touches on, because, you know, memorizing stuff is not the way, isn't going to address the challenges we have in the future. And tackling big, complicated, messy problems requires students to really think critically. And those are hard. Look, I know as a professor, you ask those kinds of questions, they're hard to grade. So we have to give teachers more time and stuff to ask and teach in that way.
What does every child deserve?
Well, they deserve an awesome education. And I am passionate about that. And I think in the sad, sad thing, and I know you want quick answers, but the sad, sad thing is if you're wealthy in this country, yeah, you get a much, much richer education than if you're not. And that isn't what this country is about. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that situation has been getting worse in the last few years.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Well, I think there's been an incredible increase in overall knowledge. And so it's not about learning facts, because every kid's got all the facts of the universe on their smartphone now. It's about thinking skills.
Yeah, that's a good point. What teacher changed your life?
That one's easy. My fourth grade teacher, I was an extremely shy kid who never spoke up. And my fourth grade teacher knew I was a science nerd at some level. And she actually sent me home with these little science projects that were like kits. Mm-hmm. And then she asked me to teach the class electricity. So in fourth grade, we built batteries that I actually taught my fourth grade class. And that teacher got me out of my shell. I wonder if I would be a scientist without her.
Wow, and look where we are today.
And yeah, who would have imagined I would have gone to MIT and started this whole program, and she's the one. I mean, and what fourth grade teacher has their student teach the lectures on did the electricity unit? My kids, some of my, at a reunion, a couple people came up to me once and said, "I remember when you taught fourth grade to our fourth grade electricity." So
that's really cool. Last question: pen or pencil?
Pencil.
Is that a scientist thing? I'm assuming that is.
Well, actually, pen. You're supposed to write your lab books in pen, but because you don't want to change them.
That's a good point.
But I just feel more at ease with a pencil.
Gotcha. Well, again, Dr. Farber, we really appreciate all your time, and we love the great things you're doing for K-12 education. I'll take an extra step and put links to y'all's website in our show notes if anyone wants to catch up.
Thank you for having me on.
All right.
Take care. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's going to do it for episode 21 of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show, and we'd really love it if you leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast. Or on Twitter, just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!
Thank you.